Radio. I'm Peter Alexander at the White House. About 400,000 homes and businesses remain without power today. Utilities in some New England states predict that the snowstorm that closed airports and shut down roadways could leave many people in the dark, at least until tomorrow. NBC's Al Roker says the dig out has begun in Boston.
It's really a winter wonderland now, but the work of cleanup goes on. This storm system did dump 21.8 inches of snow, good enough for number five in the record books.
The owner of a Portland, Maine bed and breakfast, Diane Edwards, says the snow is so deep it's not easy to get out the door.
It varies in places because it was so windy. I had a drift above my head in the driveway, and it's about up to my waist in front of the inn.
Gunshots rang out during Mardi Gras in New Orleans early this morning. Four people were wounded. Video has now surfaced of a fight just before the shooting. This is NBC News Radio. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the upcoming visit of President Obama will focus on Iran's nuclear program, the violence in Syria, and the stalled peace process with the Palestinians. NBC's Scott Carr reports former Vice President Dick Cheney has again taken to a Wyoming stage to denigrate the Obama administration.
It was less than a year ago when Cheney took to a Cheyenne stage, 3 weeks after heart surgery, to warn Americans of the disaster that would befall the country if Barack Obama was reelected.
I think he has been an unmitigated disaster for the country.
Now Cheney charges President Obama is jeopardizing U.S. national security by nominating substandard candidates for key cabinet posts. The Wyoming native made his comments Saturday night. Scott Carr, NBC News Radio, Washington.
While Rihanna tells Rolling Stone that she and Chris Brown are back together, Brown is trying to explain why he crashed his car into a wall yesterday in Los Angeles. He says he was running from paparazzi. I'm Peter Alexander, NBC News Radio.
Women, let's get honest. Do you wish you had less belly fat? Do you feel like you're losing your romantic desire? It's not your fault. You may have reduced levels of a certain hormone called DHEA. In fact, if you're over 40, your DHEA level may have already dropped as much as 40%. But now, for the first time ever, there's FemmaPro, a natural supplement that can help refill your DHEA levels. And the ingredients in FemmaPro have been shown to improve arousal, increase libido, and reduce belly fat with your diet and exercise. Finally, you can improve your romantic life, your satisfaction, and even your figure with all-natural FemmaPro. It's that easy. Women just like you are ready to take your call, so you can try FemmaPro absolutely risk-free. Call 1-800-790-6268. That's 1-800-790-6268. Call 1-800-790-6268.
Hi, this is O'Donna Matthews. What does three decades of service add up to? For the Capital Area Food Bank, it includes these important numbers. Distributing 25 million pounds of food to nearly 500,000 people through a network of 700 partner agencies. 30 years, it's a long time, but the mission continues to make sure that no one is left hungry. To learn more, contribute, or volunteer, visit capitalareafoodbank.org.
When every moment matters and a hand reaches out, when someone gives blood and a life is saved, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Every day, the Red Cross responds to nearly 200 neighborhood emergencies, and your support makes it possible. Use this moment to join us today. Visit redcross.org.
Hey everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show.
On Sunday, February 10th, Foodie and the Beast is taking a little vacay. We're going out of town to scope out someplace new. We're going to tell you all about it, but we are going to be playing one of our best ofs, so you won't be without Foodie and the Beast.
Every Sunday morning at 11, right here on 1500 AM.
The men and women of our National Guard and Reserve Forces are working hard on the battlefield and here at home. Employer support of the Guard and Reserve is working just as hard for them. For over 36 years, ESGR has paved the way for greater understanding between our Guard and Reserve Forces and their civilian employers, promoting a culture where all American employers support and honor the military service of their employees. Together, we all serve. To learn more, visit www.esgr.mil.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Colin Callahan with Callahan & Associates. We have a great lineup of guests on our show today to include Bruce Donaldson, who's the president of InTech, Dennis Kelly, the president and CEO of AT Solutions, Matthew Schenck, the president of Marymount University, and Doug Culkin, who's the president and CEO of the National Apartment Association. First up is Bruce Donaldson, who's the president of InTech. What is InTech, Bruce?
InTech is a VA certified service disabled veteran owned small business that provides support to the Department of Defense and the intelligence community. We provide everything from program management, systems engineering, to training development, and intelligence analysis support.
When was the company founded?
The company was founded 8 years ago in 2004. We're having our anniversary this month.
Well, congratulations. How big or small are you guys today?
We're at $10.7 million, or about 66 people in the company today.
And did you found the company?
I am. I'm the founder and owner of the company.
And what was going on back then that propelled you to found a company?
Well, I'd spent 21 years in the Army, retired in 1998, and then went to work for another small company in the local area. Wanted to continue supporting the federal government. And so I spent a couple years with them. They were sold to a large company, moved over to another small business, and worked for them for 2 to 3 years.
Why was it important to you to continue to support the country? You've just given a lot of years of service to the Army, and why keep going?
It runs in the blood. I come from a long line of military officers. My father, my grandfather, my uncle all served. My sister served for 10 years in the Navy, and then last September she just got back from Afghanistan where she was supporting the Defense Logistics Agency. So I've always felt that it's necessary to continue supporting the federal government in our country.
So talk to us about a little bit what it's like growing up in a military family.
It's a lot of moving. But it's really a loving environment because you're a close knit, you're always dependent on each other. And so you've always got the military member, the father in this case, who is always out doing military type things, and the mother's always there to provide the foundation, make sure things are running, and everybody gets to school on time.
So what do you remember most about being a young kid growing up in a military environment?
I think what I remember most is just the camaraderie. I've got a brother and two sisters, and we were always very close. And even when you get to a new base, you'd make friends real fast because everybody's used to the traveling and developing new friendships.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about your dad. What was he like to grow up with?
He was definitely a military officer. He was strict. But he was also loving. He ensured that we learned what life was like. He ensured that we went and got an education. He definitely believed in education. He was a leader of men. So he taught us to take responsibility, to take the lead when we saw that there was need for leadership.
And you said your grandfather was in the military too?
He was.
What can you tell us about him?
Very little. I think I was maybe one or two when he passed away. But he was also a very strong individual. Some interesting aspects. He went to the Command General Staff College with Eisenhower. He did some preliminary exploring up in Alaska for the military. So he was an interesting individual, which I wish I had been able to know a little bit better.
Yeah. What were you like as a kid?
Probably quiet, introverted.
You have brothers and sisters?
One brother, two sisters.
Uh-huh. Where are you in the birth order?
I was number two. Uh-huh. So two sisters who are younger, who we supposedly we protected, but I think we fought with them as much as we did with each other.
When did you know you were going to be in the military?
I think it was kind of in the back of my mind all along.
It just never occurred to you to do anything else?
Not really. I growing up, I was in Boy Scouts, became an Eagle Scout.
Mm-hmm.
That was all part of service. When I came out of college, I spent a couple years outside in commercial world, but realized I really my place was in the military.
So, how do you suppose you were changed by your military experience? You went in one way, you came out the other. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think it drew me out of my shell. Again, as I said, I was kind of introverted, and before I went in, again, a lot of that moving around. But when I learned leadership, mm-hmm. learned how to take responsibility, and I think the military, I mean, the education is great in the military. I picked up two advanced degrees while in the military,
mm-hmm.
and just became more worldly. We were stationed in Germany. We were stationed in Australia. My wife and two boys grew up in the military alongside me. So I think it's a great experience for anyone.
Yeah. So you retired from the military, and then a couple of years later, you started a business. What surprised you most about starting the business?
I think the most surprising thing was convincing others to join me as employees. I think I wasn't, because I'd worked for a couple small companies right out of the military, I learned a lot about what was going on in small businesses. And I think that's the great thing about being with small businesses versus a big one. A big one, you're just a cog in the wheel, but yeah. Small ones, you learn. And so, you know, when I got out, I got on my own, it was a matter of convincing people that they too should take a chance and join us. A lot of that was actually having them talk to my other employees who had taken the chance and realized that there's no better place than a small business.
So you'd had the time in the military and then a couple of jobs in smaller firms, and then something clicked and you decided you'd go out on your own. There wasn't a lot of entrepreneur in the background. What sort of sparked there for you?
No, you're right. I'd worked since I was 14, but it was always for somebody else. I think the spark was looking at how the other two small businesses were run, and how that they were treating their people as just commodities to gain them profit. I wanted to combine what I'd learned in the military with what I learned with small businesses and provide a company with a family feel, a company that looked after the employees, because I knew if you looked after the employees would support their customers.
So I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what I just heard you say is you decided to start a company that was people-focused as opposed to a specific product or service.
Exactly. That's I think that's a lot of the reason for starting it. I mean, not just to give myself a great company to work in, but also one to provide other people with a livelihood.
So, looking back on it, why was that a really good strategic move to start with people first?
Well, it's proved to be very, very I won't say profitable, but it's grown, allowed us to grow about 25% a year. I think. And it's proved to be a very good move because people bring in other people.
Mm-hmm.
People keep our customers satisfied. Keeping our customers satisfied brings us more business. So if you concentrate on the people, they'll help you grow the business.
What would you say is your number one challenge facing you as the CEO in the next 5 years?
We're as you grow a small business, there are always levels that you've got to get over.
Right.
And you've got to actually bring in the right people to get to the next level, or identify the right people that are going to help you grow. Because, you know, when you start, you do everything. When you hit 10 or 15 people, you finally start bringing in experts to help you with different things.
Right.
When you're at our level, 60, 70 people, you start to realize that you need additional people who really know how to run a business, work the processes. So I think over the next 5 years, we're going to go through several stages like that, where we have to identify the right people and empower them to help us continue growing.
Yeah, I think the best CEOs would characterize themselves as always on the learning edge of something. What's your learning edge?
It's kind of tough to say right now. I mean, we're in a very rough period for people who work with the government.
Yeah, exactly.
Because of the the budgets and everything else, and I think a lot of us who support the government realize that we do have to make the cuts. So the learning edge right now is being able to handle the downside as well as the upside, and make sure that we can keep an environment that is employee friendly, and continue to do our work to support the government.
Yeah. How much longer would you like to be doing this, Bruce?
I haven't got an end date. If it grows to too big a company, then I'm out of here.
That'd be a horrible problem, wouldn't it?
True, but I like the small company feel.
What would you say the most significant thing you've ever accomplished is?
That's probably marrying my wife. We've been married for 39 years now.
Mm-hmm.
So without her, probably wouldn't be where I am now.
Yeah, great. What's the website address, Bruce?
The website is www.intecllc.net.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Bruce Donaldson, who's the president of Intec. I'd like to thank my co-host, Colin Callahan, with Callahan & Associates. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment, right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Dana Theus with Empower Consulting, and this is your Business Spotlight. I'm joined today by...
My name is Lindsay Kinn.
And what company are you with?
I'm actually with an organization called Luke's Wings. It's a 501c3 nonprofit. We provide airline tickets, complimentary emergency or rotational airline tickets for injured service members and their families in and out of military hospitals across the country.
And what's your role?
I'm the executive director of business development. We're actually a small team of just three people, so I oversee all the fundraising.
What makes the organization most special?
Most special to me is the fact that we have such a direct impact on our military families. There's a lot of organizations that are doing wonderful work, but they're also doing a lot of different things. Luke's Wings is an organization that does one thing, which is provide airline tickets to keep our families together during very dark moments in their life. So by choosing to do one thing and doing it as to the best of our ability, we're able to have a direct impact on the most deserving families that we can think of.
And what do you personally enjoy most about your work?
It's very hard to put into words the difference I think we make, because there's nothing more important than having your family with you. It's hard to know how important that is when it's something you don't think about. But by providing these tickets, we're keeping families together. We're keeping children with their parents, and we're keeping husbands and wives together. And I love that we have the opportunity to do that.
That's wonderful. What brought you to the company?
I was a volunteer for 2 years. We got enough funding in 2011 to add someone to the staff full time. I took on that responsibility, and in the last year, we've raised about $1.3 million and been able to provide over 1,000 airline tickets.
Wonderful. How would someone contact you if they wanted to find the organization?
I would love to hear from anyone who'd like to get involved as a corporate sponsor, a volunteer, and we can be reached at www.lukeswings.org.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Colin Callahan with Callahan & Associates. And for this segment, we have Dennis Kelly, who's the president and CEO of AT Solutions. What is AT Solutions, Dennis?
Well, AT is anti-terrorism, so we're focused on the anti-counterterrorism business, supporting our federal government and allied nations against the counterterrorism, or to support the counterterrorism mission.
So can you give us an example of what that might look like in reality?
Sure. Well, certainly, you know, here in the homeland, you know, as our Department of Homeland Security, our Federal Bureau of Investigation, ATF, are looking to protect the homeland from terrorist attacks. We support them really in the full continuum of, you know, from intelligence through training and preparation, if you will. And if unfortunately an event happens, evidence collection, CSI, crime scene investigation kind of support.
So you guys cover from soup to nuts anything that has to do with terrorism support?
We do, yes.
How old is the company?
Company's just over 10 years old.
And how big or small today?
We're just over 800 people, and we just crossed over $200 million in revenue.
That's a lot of growth in 10 years.
It is.
How long have you been with the firm?
I've been with the firm just under 5 years, about half the company's life so far.
In the capacity of president and CEO?
No, I actually started as the company's first chief operating officer. Mm-hmm. A private equity firm had partnered with the company back in 2008, and collectively, the founder and the private equity partner thought they needed someone to help the company put the infrastructure in place, the business development processes, so on and so forth, to take the company to the next level.
So that was the role of the COO?
That's correct, the COO role.
And then when did you take over as president and CEO?
I took over in January of 2010, mm-hmm. So a little over 3 years ago.
And what's the difference between a COO and a CEO?
Well, that's a great question. COO is, I think, more internally focused, more focused on the day-to-day operation, more focused on execution. The CEO, while he cares about those things, is more concerned with the outside strategic perspective, where the company's going, you know, what the next hurdle might be that the company has to get over. I liken it to, if you think of a car, the CEO is kind of looking in the windshield, and the COO is looking at the dashboard in a rearview mirror, you know, just to keep the car running properly.
So how have you prepared yourself across time to be a good CEO? What's it take, in your opinion?
Well, I think we're largely a services business, so we're people intensive. So you have to be skilled at leading people toward a common goal. So I think it kind of starts back when I was in the Navy, you know, working with people and leading people. You know, obviously there's business preparation. You know, I had my business education. I think my MBA really helped me a great deal in terms of preparing me for the role.
So there's the people piece. What about the strategy piece?
Strategy is very important. I mean, you have to have a blueprint for where you're going.
Yeah.
And you have to have a blueprint. People have to understand where the company's going and how you're going
to
get there.
Yeah, talk to us a little bit about strategy. What's involved in being a good strategist?
Well, I think first thing is strategy has to be a team strategy. It has to be the company strategy.
Why a team?
Because if it's just my strategy, it's, you know, I'm only one person. I only have one perspective. You need many perspectives of the entire team. So we put a lot of effort as we do strategic planning into really getting the input of the entire organization, and mm-hmm. we do surveys and data collection so that when we go do our strategic planning sessions, it's really got the benefit of the whole company's input.
Yeah, so strategy can be 1 month out, it can be 5 years out.
Mm-hmm.
What do you pay most attention to?
Well, we have a three-year strategy. We think going beyond 3 years is a bit too far out mm-hmm. for our business. So we do a three-year strategic plan and a one-year action plan. So we have a three-year strategy, but it's, you know, the subset of that is, okay, what specific actions are we going to take over the next year? Yeah.
Not everybody can see 3 years out and do it well. When did you realize you could?
Well, I think, I think that's something probably back in my Antion days. I mean, we used to do strategic planning there, mm-hmm. and I realized the benefit of it, and I watched what tremendous growth it drove for the company.
Yeah. When you were a kid, were you thinking about the future, or what was going on?
Oh, sure. I was thinking about the future as a kid. I think, you know, I think when you're a kid, your future is not maybe as long-term as it gets when you get older. You start to think a little bit broader when you get older, but I certainly thought about joining the Navy and what I might do, seeing the world, that right. sort of thing. But I think as I got into business, you start to take a longer-term perspective.
You are very involved with the Wounded Warriors.
I am.
As a company and personally. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, our company supports the Wounded EOD Warrior Foundation.
EOD means what?
Explosive Ordnance Disposal. They're basically the bomb techs in the military. It's a joint community. So regardless of what service you're in, they all go, you know, at least initially to the same schools and whatnot. And they're the folks that have been out there both in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places around the world, combating the IED threat, the improvised explosive device. And this community has taken a disproportionate hit. They're a small community, and obviously we've heard about the IEDs as being the number one casualty driver, if you will.
Why does it matter to you?
It matters to me because our company, one of the things we do is train this community. Train them to come home alive. So we have a lot of subject matter experts who have been doing this for decades, and they provide training and support. And whenever we hear about just one EOD tech being injured or, God forbid, casualty, we take it very personally because, yeah. you know, somehow we feel like, gee, did we do everything we could have done to bring that right. bring that service member home?
Right. What's the one thing you'd like to tell us about Wounded Warriors?
I think Wounded Warriors don't want to be viewed as victims. Obviously they're in unfortunate circumstances, but they have a lot to offer.
Yeah.
And I think what they would want, what I've learned in speaking with a number of them is they want to contribute. They want to continue to serve their country, right. Support the mission. So I think that that's one thing that people might not realize.
You were telling us in the green room that the mission of the company is very personal to you as well because of a personal incident that happened to you way back when. Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. September 11th, 2001, when, of course, we were hit as a nation. My cousin was a firefighter that went up into one of the towers of the World Trade Center and unfortunately did not make it. It's very personal for our family, obviously, losing a family member like that.
How did it impact you?
At first I didn't even know it happened. Things were so confusing during that time. It took probably a couple of weeks for us to all really understand what happened. But it greatly impacted me. I remembered my cousin as a child and interacting with him at family events and whatnot. Hadn't seen him in quite a while, but I definitely remembered him and just thinking of him and what he must have been thinking and knowing that he was a firefighter going up into a tower that was obviously in flames to save others was something that really impacted me.
Pretty heroic.
Absolutely.
Where are you from, Dennis?
Originally from New Jersey.
What was it like growing up in New Jersey?
Well, as we were talking about before, a little bit like a gypsy. My family moved around a lot, and I think I lived in most parts of northern New Jersey. So it was a great childhood.
What were mom and dad doing when you were growing up?
Dad was a truck driver. Mom was a waitress.
So hardworking folks.
Very hardworking folks. Yep, absolutely.
How do you suppose that impacted you?
Well, two things. One, I think my mom and dad, I think, instilled in me the value of hard work. But they also, I think, pointed out the value of education. And even though they didn't have a college education, they impressed upon me how important it was to get one at some point in your life. So
right.
I think those two things.
You also mentioned a significant mentor along the way, Commander Vaden, I think his name was.
Absolutely, Commander Vaden. When I was in high school, I joined the Navy Junior ROTC unit, and Commander Vaden was the commanding officer.
Why did you do that? Join the ROTC?
You know, I felt like I wanted to be part of something. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a jock. I wasn't really a sports guy, although I played a little baseball. It wasn't really my thing. I wanted to be part of a group.
Uh-huh.
And the ROTC unit, I think, provided me that opportunity.
And how did Commander Vaden impact you?
Well, Commander Vaden was very hard on me, which I think was good. He held me accountable. Excuses weren't a good thing with Commander Vaden. And he wouldn't just track your progress in the ROTC unit. He wanted a copy of your report card for all your classes every semester. And you had to sit down with him every semester, and he wanted to know what was going on with this class and that class. So he held me accountable.
And what other influences in your early life?
You know, certainly mom and dad were a big influence. You know, I mentioned the, you know, the work ethic and whatnot.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I did. Yeah, I had three sisters and one brother. Mm-hmm. I also had an aunt and uncle out in Missouri that were, I used to go to their farm every summer for a couple of weeks. They were big influences in my life.
Mm-hmm. What would you say the most difficult thing you have ever accomplished is?
The most difficult thing that I ever accomplished? That's a good question. I would say my last company that I was in was a government services company that was working inside of a commercial parent. And I think that mixed business model of, you know, working, you know, government services in a commercial-oriented business was a bit of a culture difference.
Yeah. What's the website address for AT Solutions, Dennis?
It's www.a-tsolutions.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Dennis Kelly, who's the president and CEO of AT Solutions. I'd like to thank Colin Callahan with Callahan & Associates for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our clients' best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses. And a broker has is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380. Or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Colin Callahan with Callahan & Associates. And for this segment, we have Matt Schenck, who's the president of Marymount University. Tell us a little bit about Marymount, Matt.
First of all, thank you for having me on. Marymount is a comprehensive Catholic university founded in 1950. It's located in beautiful Arlington, Virginia, and we have about 3,800 students at this point.
What does comprehensive mean?
When we talk about comprehensive, a lot of people still believe that Marymount is a two-year women's school, which is our route. And comprehensive to us means that we have undergraduate programs, a full array of master's degree programs, and we also have three doctoral programs in the health professions and in counseling. So we're a full-service university, not just undergraduate degrees anymore.
And in your opinion, why should somebody select this university over something else?
It's a great question, and obviously we try to differentiate ourselves in many ways, but what we would really claim and what we do is that we provide a real student experience, a student-centered experience where faculty and students interact. And, of course, any university would say that we have a quality educational experience. But Marymount, because of the size of the student body and the interaction that they get with their faculty inside the classroom and more importantly, outside the classroom, we really believe that we can provide a unique experience.
Now, so how would you differentiate between the educational experience and the student experience?
Well, some of our students obviously live on campus, so when you think about that, we've got, you know, approaching 4,000 students, about 1,000 live on the campus of Marymount, so they spend X number of hours in the classroom, but a large percentage of their time is spent outside the classroom. So the activities that we provide to those students, whether it be intercollegiate athletics, being on a student organization, being involved in campus ministry, that's a huge part of their overall experience at Marymount. So something that we spend a lot of time working on.
How long have you been the president?
Almost 2 years.
Why would you say you were the ideal pick for this position?
Well, I don't know if I am the ideal pick, to be honest. I hope I am over time and grow into being the ideal pick. But I think one of the reasons that I was chosen is that I have a lot of experience in fundraising, a lot of experience in external relations. I happen to be a marketing professor, so a lot of marketing experience. And one of the things that Marymount wants to do is generate more awareness and exposure, even in this region where we live. A lot of people don't know about the programs that Marymount offers, so we're in a real push right now to get the word out about the great school that we have.
Yeah, I'll bet most people listening in don't know exactly what a university president does on a day-to-day basis. Tell us a little bit about a typical day for you.
Well, I think the typical day is, as with most CEOs, there is no typical day.
Get up early, go to bed late.
Absolutely. Really, a lot of my job, as I said, is moving towards external relations. So I'll spend time with people in the business community, spend time with alums, go out and try to raise money for the university. Almost every night, you will find me at another dinner function, which I enjoy, by the way, or I wouldn't have wanted to take this job. But again, really trying to be an ambassador for Marymount. Now, I couple that with all the internal functions of a president of any university, and so I do have to ultimately approve curriculum decisions and things going on at the university. So tied back to the whole notion of marketing, we are really trying to emphasize service quality on our campus. How do we treat our students outside of the classroom and inside of the classroom? So again, that's another part of the job that I oversee.
Yeah, and you were telling us in the green room that your path to this role isn't the most traditional one. You come from a marketing background, so talk to us a little about that.
That's correct. My degrees are all in psychology, and then more specifically, not to bore the audience, experimental psychology. So I spent a lot of time learning about statistics, experimental design. So my first job after my PhD was with a marketing research company, even though I didn't really have a marketing degree. And from there, started teaching part-time at night and then decided I wanted to make the shift into education as a career.
So are you saying that that kind of shaped the way that you see the world, that enables you to lead the university maybe in a better way that others couldn't?
Well, I think I definitely have a marketing perspective. And my degree, I focused a lot on, no pun intended, but focused a lot on perception.
Yeah.
So how people see things. And certainly the way that they see Marymount is a big part of my job. I want them to see it and position Marymount in a certain light. So it's a lot of what I do.
Great. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in beautiful St. Louis, Missouri.
St. Louis Cardinals.
St. Louis Cardinals, America's team, as I call it. Winner of 13 World Series titles. Unfortunately, for the Nats fans out there, they put an end to the Nats season. But and then the tides were turned on the Cardinals in the next series where they were up 3-1 and ended up losing.
So you have a big smile on your face when you think of your St. Louis days. What was it like growing up in the Midwest?
I've always lived in the Midwest, so this is the first what I would call East Coast city or Atlantic city that I've ever lived in. And, as you hear from most people that grew up in the Midwest, they had a great experience, very much a family oriented experience, as was the case for me.
Well, what were Mom and Dad doing while you were growing up?
Well, believe it or not, they moved when I was in fourth grade about a mile and still live in the same house today that I grew up in. And my father was a doctor. My mother was a librarian for St. Louis County.
Uh-huh. And how do you suppose they shaped you looking back on it?
Well, I spent a lot of time around books, which is probably why I don't want to spend that much time today reading books. No, just kidding. But obviously being in that environment where my mother was a librarian and I even worked part-time in the library, while I was in high school, so a lot of that shaped, you know, my love of books and education.
So you got some undergraduate degrees in psychology and then marketing. How did you find yourself in academics?
Well, as I said, I made the shift. I started teaching part-time and really loved the classroom experience and didn't think I, you know, would love it so much, and decided that it was really more of a calling for me personally to be in an academic setting. And so moving from my part-time experience to a visiting professorship in marketing at the University of Mississippi, Ole Miss, and then from there just sort of taking off.
Yeah. Talk about the shift from teaching to the administrative side of the business.
Well, that's a great question, because for some faculty, it's just a route that they don't want to go, and they're very comfortable and happy in the classroom and interacting with students.
Why did you want to go that route?
Well, to be honest, and this will sound a little cliche, but I think I felt like I could make a bigger difference for more students, and now certainly leading a university with 4,000 students, a faculty member can make a great difference in the lives of the students that they teach. I can make a difference with more students, if you will, and so that they have even a better experience.
Right.
So I'm curious about your studies in perception. When did you first find you were fascinated about perception, and what were the influences there?
That's another great question, because I don't know if there was any particular event that caused me to think about studying perception. But as an undergraduate, I will tell you that I had a faculty mentor that got me involved in a lot of research as an undergraduate. So I had my first academic journal publication as a senior. And that's something today that we still try to really pursue and push at Marymount, to have our undergraduate students involved in research with faculty members. It's an unbelievable experience for them. And that really got the juices flowing for me in terms of, you know, thinking about going on and pursuing a master's degree and then a PhD. So I don't know if there was one particular event that caused me to want to move into perception.
Yeah. So you've been around the education industry for quite a while now. In what way has it changed?
Well, there's so much going on, as I'm sure you know and read, about higher education, about accountability, about a liberal arts degree, and will that translate then into a job, about online learning, about the cost of education. So again, as the president, we have to keep abreast. All of us have to keep abreast of these trends and
figure
out how we're going to adapt and change.
At the end of the day, you're offering a product for sale. How do you keep it relevant and competitive?
Well, what we try to do at Marymount, any new programs that we would start, we would certainly want to make sure that there's a market need, not only for students, but equally important from employers. And so some of our successful programs right now in the healthcare industry and cybersecurity certainly are a nice fit for really anywhere in the country, but especially this area. So we want to make sure that those programs that are existing also adapt, and so we're constantly looking at the curriculum, making sure that it's still relevant.
How has the student body changed over the years?
Well, at Marymount in particular, it's an unbelievable shift. We went from, in 1950, 15 white women who were of a privileged class, and Marymount was almost seen as a finishing school, to today, where we're the third most diverse university in the South. We have 15% of our students are international students. We've got a large percentage of African American and Hispanic students. So it is a great melting pot at Marymount right now. And so a lot of our students, even though we're a private university, we're very affordable. So we serve a lot of first generation students. So we're very proud of the diversity that we have.
Great. What's your proudest moment been up till now?
Probably when I threw a one-hitter against Air Force when I was pitching in college. No, just teasing. Really, I've been at Marymount a very short period of time, but I think, what I'm most proud of at Marymount is being able to develop relationships with people in this area in a short period of time. And that's not because of me. It's because of the great people that live and work in Arlington and the Northern Virginia area.
Yeah, what's the website address for the university, Matt?
The website is www.marymount.edu, and I would encourage you all to visit it and learn more about our programs.
We'll do that. Thank you. That was Matt Shank, who's the president of Marymount University. I'd like to thank my co-host, Colin Callahan, with Callahan & Associates. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment after this Business Spotlight. This is your Business Spotlight, brought to you by Peter Schwartz, a Vistage chair with Vistage International. And joining us today is...
Pat Chance.
Pat, who are you with?
I am with CompuData, where I am the Director of Business Development in the D.C. metropolitan area.
And what is CompuData?
CompuData is a technology company delivering end-to-end solutions. And by that, we deliver business management software, which really includes Sage and Epicor ERP. Along with that, we also provide hardware, technical support and planning, hosting, disaster recovery, and professional services to meet the needs of our customers.
Wow. What makes your business special?
What makes our company so special? We've been in business now for 41 years. Our president and CEO is Angela Nadeau, and she was honored most recently in Forbes magazine as the 100 most powerful women in business. Along with that, we've won many business awards, such as Accounting Technology, VAR 100, and the Business Journal.
Oh, and what do you enjoy most about your job?
I enjoy helping companies and, most importantly, people, helping them find the right solution to run their businesses effectively.
And why do you think your customers appreciate you?
They appreciate us because we are the trusted advisor. They depend on CompuData to deliver the right solution to help run their businesses.
How can someone reach you?
At www.compudata.com, and please visit me on LinkedIn.
That's great. We've been speaking with Pat, who's with CompuData. This is Peter Schwartz, and this has been your Spotlight for the day. Have a great day. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Colin Callahan, with Callahan & Associates. And for this segment, we have Doug Culkin, who's the president and CEO of the National Apartment Association. Tell us a little bit about the National Apartment Association, Doug.
Happy to, Peter. It's an organization that's almost 75 years old. We represent owners, builders, managers, developers of apartment communities across the United States. We have approximately 66,000 members and 170 local, state, and local affiliates.
And so there's a professional association for these folks, these owners. What does the association do for them?
Well, we have a three-legged stool that most associations do, and we sort of narrow in on it. Advocacy at the federal level and at the state and local level is very important.
What does that mean,
important.
Advocacy?
Is we go out and we lobby on behalf of our members for legislation that hopefully will be beneficial to them, or if there's legislation that could be harmful to the industry, we lobby against it. And obviously, in any of these cases, you have to go in, you have to be very truthful, you have to be knowledgeable about something. And if you don't know the answers, you have to say, I don't know, and I'll get back to you. But obviously, we're all in this together, all industries, all individuals. They're looking for tax money, and we would just want to make sure it's proportionate and reasonable, so it's spread across the board and everyone has the same risk and the same reward.
So it's not just advocacy at the federal level, it's at the state and local level too?
Yes, it is.
So how do you keep up with all those various regulations and rules?
We subscribe to several monitoring services run by LexisNexis, which gives you, and what we do is anything that has tenant owner-tenant law in the title, we search on that, and so in every city council and in every state legislature, that information is put out. We contact our local affiliates that are impacted in these areas. We let them know about the legislation, make sure they know it's been introduced, and if they need any help in preparing either an advocacy or a defensive position, we have staff available to do that for them, and if they need it, to go out to that part of the country and testify on their behalf.
And how long have you been the president and CEO?
Since August of 1999.
So that's quite a while now. Why did you want the job?
Well, I like a challenge. I knew when I interviewed that the organization had been on hard times. The financial results and the benefits that the members wanted weren't being produced. And I've had a reputation in the past of helping to turn around organizations. But primarily, I liked what the organization was doing. And we provide housing, quality housing, to over 100 million people living in the United States.
I mean, that's an enormous statistic. 100 million people is what you impact.
Yes.
That's almost half the population.
Well, it's about... Not quite. It's about a little over a third of the population, right, where I think we're at about 270 million in the U.S. right mm-hmm. now. And so we're at about 100 million people in the United States who rent housing.
Wow. And so how do you spend the bulk of your day in the role?
Well, I have got several charges. One is to implement what the policies of the board, to make sure that those are happening and that we are providing the products and services that the members need so that they're successful and in turn their investment in real estate continues to be profitable so that they stay in the industry. The second thing is we're now in the process of doing a reorganization of the association, what we call from first class to world class. We feel we're good, but we have three or four steps we need to make so that we can be in a category all by ourselves within that marketplace. And so I'm spending a lot of time looking at what we have identified as areas we need to improve within the organization, internally within the association, from a governance standpoint, and also looking at the groups that we work with or would want to work with who haven't been active in making them more involved in the association.
What do you like most about the job?
I love the challenges. Every day you walk in, there's something different. It's not the same old that so many people I know, you know, who moan and groan about their jobs. I can go in with a set agenda, and within 5 minutes I've thrown it out because something has happened that my attention is needed to work with it, and then I'll go out and find the different staff members on our team. Who are going to help me solve that.
So have you been involved in associations your entire professional career?
No, I started out in the banking industry when I graduated from college. I had thought about being an attorney and realized that was not something I wanted to do. So the university I went to, which is a college of cooperative education, wound up getting me a job in my local hometown. I was fascinated by money and the role that money played in business and economy and creating jobs. And I was just drawn to it, and I realized that's what I wanted to do.
So talk about your progression across time. What kind of roles have you played?
Well, I started out, I was the youngest vice president in the Bank of Virginia banking system, called on associations. I think I told you earlier they made me a significant increase in pay. Started out in the meetings department. I knew nothing about organizing meetings and providing all of the commodities and the benefits that people need when they're at a meeting. You know, housing, restaurants, organized facilities for meetings, organized facilities for networking opportunities and parties and dinners. I didn't have a clue, but they had the confidence in me that I could get the job done, so it was a learning experience. I then, shortly after I started, I received my MBA in finance and investment, so my next position was as the chief financial officer of an association, and then briefly got out, and I was president and CEO of a publicly held company for a couple of years. Didn't like that because it was pretty much uniform every day, and I do like the challenge and change. And then since I came back from that, the last 20 years, 10 years with one organization and 13 now with NAAF, I've been the CEO of the organization.
What do you think makes for a good CEO?
Well, you can't be afraid to make a mistake. You can't be afraid to fail because that's how you learn and that's how you improve the organization.
Talk to us about a mistake that you made that you really learned from.
Oh, I could give you 20 of them, but, you know, I think the biggest thing is in associations, because you have so many bosses, basically right. Everyone who's a member is a boss, lots of people have frozen because they're going to be criticized. And you have to learn that that's part of what makes a good CEO. When you've made mistakes and you've learned from them, you don't make them in the future. And it gives you more confidence in your decision-making ability to look at, analyze, and say, this is what we have to do.
Yeah.
And that's one of the great things about associations, at least for me, is that the opportunities I've had have given me plenty of opportunities to look at things that had gone wrong, what I might have done to make them better, hopefully, and then make decisions that, you know, in more cases than not, I've made a good decision.
So I'm detecting your accent is not a Northern Virginia native accent.
No, it is not,
Colin.
Tell us about your
early life.
I grew up in Boston. Neither of my parents had the opportunity to go to college. They were both first generation.
You actually tell a very endearing story about your father. Why don't you explore that a little bit with us?
Oh, sure. My dad was from a large Irish Catholic family. He was one of nine. He was the oldest son. He had been accepted to attend college at Harvard, which was very unusual at that time. But within 6 months, both of his parents died, and he had to take over responsibility for raising his younger siblings. He was two boys and seven sisters in the family, and he wound up getting a job that today we would look at as being not on the straight and narrow, but it was with a bookie, with the brother of John W. McCormick, who later became the Speaker of the House during the Kennedy administration and afterwards. And it allowed him to earn the money that he needed to bring all of his siblings up, to see that they were all married and settled in their lives before then he did the same thing himself. So he has been my biggest role model always throughout my career.
Well, looking back on it, what do you think you got the greatest gift your father gave you?
The ability to love life and be there for people. And I told you earlier, I don't think I really appreciated what he did, but even with all of his sisters, when they were older and they were married and they had big families themselves, whenever there was a crisis in any of their families, my dad was always the person they called, and my dad always made the time to go and see them, sit down with the family, and work things out. And it was that sort of giving of himself,
yeah,
in whatever the situation was.
Is your dad still with us?
Unfortunately, no, he's not.
Was he aware of your success?
He started to see in some of the things that I'd done. I was in a publicly held company.
Well, if I was interviewing him right now, would he be surprised?
I hope not. And I hope he would be very proud of me as I was of him.
Well, if he was sitting here right now, what would you want to say to him?
Dad, I love you and I miss you every day.
Great. What's the website address for the Apartment Association?
www.naahq.org.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Doug Culkin, who's the president and CEO of the National Apartment Association. I'd like to thank my co-host, Colin Callahan, with Callahan & Associates for helping me structure the interviews today. We've had a great lineup of guests on the show, including Bruce Donaldson, the president of InTech, Dennis Kelly, the president and CEO of AT Solutions, Matt Schenck, the president of Marymount University, and finally Doug Culkin, who's the president and CEO of the National Apartment Association. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a show. Stay tuned. We'll talk to you again next week. Talk to you later. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News